Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. We first brought you Antonio Neal's story on June 30th, 2018. To refresh your memory, we're going to include the original episode with an update at the end. If you remember this episode well, you can fast forward to around the 53-minute mark where the update begins.
I was frightened. You know, we couldn't find him anywhere. And Antonio always talks to me like he doesn't go 3 days without communicating with me one way or another. And so it was very strange that a week went by, I didn't hear from him, and then Christmas came, and I was like, gosh, he has to be home for Christmas, of course. You know, that kid wouldn't miss Christmas for anything. And Christmas came and went, and still no Antonio.
22-year-old Antonio Neal disappeared from Everett, Washington on December 12, 2016. Antonio had spent most of the day with his mom, Jenny. Later that evening, he was picked up by a friend to go spend the night at his house. When Antonio left his mom's house that evening, that was the last time she ever saw her son. In the days that followed, a bizarre story surfaced about what transpired on the evening of the 12th. A story that has left both Antonio's family and detectives wondering what is the truth and what could possibly be a cover-up. Antonio has now been missing for over 18 months, and in those 18 months, his case has gone from a missing persons case to a no-body homicide investigation and back to a missing case. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 129 of The Vanished, Antonio Neal's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices and audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Antonio was born and raised in Everett, Washington, where he had many friends. It wasn't until Antonio went to college that his life took a turn. During his first year of college, Antonio was introduced to heroin, and he eventually dropped out of school. After that, he was in and out of jail for some time until he got clean. By the fall of 2016, after being clean for a year, Antonio relapsed. I'm sure that many of you listening care about someone who is struggling with addiction. It's a tough thing to watch someone go through and often leaves you feeling powerless, even though you want to do everything you can to help. Many feel torn between being supportive while also trying not to enable. Antonio's mom, Jenny, went through this too and eventually took a tough love approach.
When he first started using, you know, we had him in treatment and then he was still staying at home. But then when he'd use at our house, we weren't going to condone that and enable him to be able to use while at home. And so we kicked him out when he was 18, when he was using the heroin, because I'm not going to enable him to have a real easy place to sit there and use drugs when I'm at work. Me and his stepdad are at work all day long, you know, and a tough love, but he was very close still, you know, but just we wouldn't let him stay here. He was really good about, like, I would text him every day. We'd talk every day on the phone and be like, are you okay? You know, can you please do this or do that? You know, make sure you go to treatment. Make sure you go, you know, do this. I still micromanaged him through the telephone. And would help him get into, you know, places to live. Since he was 18, I mean, he stayed with his cousin for a long time. He stayed with my brother. He stayed with sober houses. He stayed at his dad's. So he's always had somewhere to go, but we've let him come back, you know, and of course he abused that again. And
Jenny told me about the months leading up to Antonio's disappearance.
Antonio had recently relapsed on drugs probably 2 or 3 months earlier, and he had been clean for a year, and he had his car stolen, and along in his car was his cell phone and his wallet and everything, pretty much everything he had, you know, because he was house hopping at the time. When he relapsed, he got kicked out of his, or asked to leave out of his sober house that he was staying at. So when his car got stolen, apparently that same day, he turned himself into the DOC for the relapse and spent a month in jail. And during the time in jail, his uncle, my brother, died suddenly of sepsis that led to heart failure. And Antonio found out in jail, and he was really upset, the process. He had a few weeks in jail to process all that.
The death of his uncle was particularly hard on Antonio because the two had been very close since they were only 6 years apart in age.
When he got out of jail, the day he came, I picked him up from the bus stop. And, you know, he was happy to be out of jail, but sad about his uncle. And at the time, since the relapse, he doesn't stay with us because of the drug use on and off again. And he came to our house, we ate dinner, and then he went to a friend's house and he said he'd be back in the morning. So in the morning he came, he got out on December 11th, 2016, and he came over in the morning, December 12th, 2016. And we spent the whole day together. He was in good spirits that day. I was just driving him around to get him a new driver's license. And we stopped to find out about like housing, you know, new sober housing and stuff. And we ordered him a new telephone because he had his stolen along with his vehicle. That evening, he was using my phone to contact friends to see where maybe he can stay until he gets into another sober house. And he got a friend of his, hold of his friend, Andrew. And I've known Andrew for a long time. He's actually not a real close friend of Antonio's, but he used to date Antonio's cousin. So that's how we know him. And Andrew said that he could come stay with him at his house as long as he needs to. And I know Andrew uses drugs too. But at the time, Andrew said he was trying to stay clean and he was about to be going to treatment, and that he was going to encourage Antonio to go into treatment with him. So I was like, okay. He came over, got Antonio. Antonio left. He had a backpack that I filled up with some clothes for him because mainly all his stuff was at our house, shoes, clothes, everything he needs. So he always just came home and got stuff when he needed it. I filled up a backpack and I gave him a duffel bag with a pillow and a sleeping bag in it. And he left to Andrew's house. Apparently something happened that night between the two. I guess they got in an altercation and Andrew said Antonio stabbed him and left. And there were 7 people in that house, but nobody saw this. Andrew did go to the hospital. He wasn't seriously hurt. And Antonio had been gone ever since that night.
Andrew had dated Antonio's cousin, Jenny's niece, and the following day he got in touch with her niece and said that after Antonio had stabbed him, he had run out of the house and never returned. Jenny's niece was alarmed after hearing this story and decided to contact her and let her know what had allegedly happened. In a panic, Jenny called Andrew. She had his number because Antonio had messaged Andrew from her phone looking for a place to stay.
So I was like, oh my gosh, what happened? Is Antonio on the run? I was thinking something happened to, and you know, Antonio, who knows what happened between the two. But according to Andrew, he didn't want to talk to the police at all. He did not want to tell the police what happened to Antonio, or what happened that Antonio assaulted him. He didn't want to give names. He was very persistent about that. The cops couldn't get anything out of him that Antonio did this, because he said he was protecting Antonio. And so I was frightened. You know, we couldn't find him anywhere. And Antonio always talks to me. Like, he doesn't go 3 days without communicating with me one way or another, whether it's coming over, calling me, texting me through somebody's phone. Usually he has his own phone. And so it was very strange that a week went by, I didn't hear from him. Christmas came and I was like, gosh, he has to be home for Christmas. Of course, that kid wouldn't miss Christmas for anything. And Christmas came and went and still no Antonio.
Jenny hadn't gone to the police yet. She didn't file a missing persons report during the first 2 weeks. She had no reason not to believe Andrew at first. She thought if Antonio was using, maybe he was scared that he had hurt Andrew. Maybe he was cooling off. Jenny was sure that he would get in touch with her. But one thing that Jenny felt uneasy about was that Antonio had never gone anywhere near this amount of time without contacting her. And people were talking. People were saying that something bad had gone down at Andrew's place. Because he had dated her niece, Jenny had known Andrew for a while. He and Antonio were friends, but they didn't have a strong friendship. Andrew's roommates didn't even know Antonio well. And according to Jenny, there was no reason for there to be any beef between the two of them. But she was being told that Andrew may have done something to Antonio.
So about 2 weeks after he left Andrew's house, I filed a missing person on him and immediately turned to Facebook and started sharing Antonio's missing poster I made and got some false leads, you know, oh yeah, maybe he was here and I think I saw him here, but nothing ever matched up. Nobody was ever able to say anything. I even interviewed with David Rose for the Washington's Most Wanted. He ran a story on Antonio. I think it was like the end of January 2017. I got a Facebook message from one of Andrew's roommates, David, and he told me that he had important information about Antonio's disappearance. So I immediately gave that information to my detective. He called David, and I guess David disclosed that he was Andrew's roommate or one of Andrew's roommates and that there was blood all over Andrew's room and he thinks Andrew did something to get rid of Antonio.
The Snohomish County Sheriff's Office went public with a plea for help. Had anyone seen Antonio after he allegedly, according to Andrew, fled the house after this altercation? Could he have been on the run? Andrew wouldn't tell the police that Antonio had stabbed him, so it wasn't like he was running from charges related to this alleged stabbing.
I have no idea where he would hide. And I think with drug use and everything, he would have been picked up. There's been a couple circumstances where if he didn't have anywhere to go, he turns himself in. He doesn't stay on the streets or anything. He's never done that. He's a pretty boy. He always has to be clean and well-kept and wear nice clothes. And he would know he would worry me to death. And especially with me blasting him all over social media, he would have given me a heads up. Mom, chill out.
The story about the alleged stabbing struck Jenny as odd from the start because it just seemed so out of character for her son.
He's not a violent guy. No, he's not a gangster or violent or thinks he's hard. He's actually a very caring, loving, empathetic guy. He has lots and lots of friends and everybody loves him. Very outgoing, always wanted to be in the action doing something. He liked all type of people. You know, he's not judgmental at meetings or whatever. When he'd go to NA meetings, he'd talk to everybody, every type of person. He wasn't like that. But Andrew had violence in his history as far as he thought he was kind of gangster and hard and carried guns sometimes, things like that.
The house where they'd all been hanging out at was rented by a couple of friends, Isaac and David, and Andrew rented a room from them. Both Isaac and David's girlfriends were also there that night, and there was a group of other people hanging out at the house that night too. Numerous people in the house were allegedly doing drugs, apparently methamphetamine and Antonio's drug of choice, heroin. Witnesses who were at the house that night have said that both Andrew and Antonio were using, but the story of how the altercation happened was still blurry. Then Jenny started hearing rumors and bits and pieces of information from people who had been at the house. She began to realize that there was a chance that someone in the house knew more and maybe they were just too scared to speak up. Now, Jenny's worst fears were starting to be realized, and with the new information coming from the roommates, the Everett Police Department had no choice but to explore the possibility that this may have been a homicide. This is when the investigation went from a missing person to a no-body homicide investigation. After hearing the following information about that night, they went to search the last house Antonio was seen at. They got statements from the roommates and a few other people they could locate who were at the house that evening. According to all witnesses, no one had seen any altercation between Andrew and Antonio. But they all seemed to believe that Antonio was dead and Andrew had something to do with it. One witness spoke about the last time she saw Antonio.
He was sitting in Andrew's room and he had just a white t-shirt on and some jeans in his shoes. And he was like looking down at the floor. The other roommates that were in the house, I guess there's an upstairs too, were upstairs and nobody apparently saw anything. So
Andrew said that night he realized he needed some groceries, so he went out to the store. When he returned, people were in the house, but mainly upstairs. According to Andrew, he was walking down the hallway with the groceries in his hands when Antonio came at him out of nowhere and slashed at his neck, stabbing him unprovoked. The problem is, none of the roommates saw him come and go to the grocery store. They knew that Andrew nor Antonio had any money. Andrew had a food stamp card with no money on it, and Antonio didn't have any money since his wallet had been stolen. The roommates also never saw any new groceries in the home. They just didn't believe that this had happened, at least not how Andrew was saying it unfolded. One of the women who was at the house that night told police that Andrew came in and woke her up after she had gone to bed for the night.
Andrew came to the girl and got her out of bed saying that Antonio stabbed him and he needed to go to the hospital. And then he proceeded to go into his room and she noticed in his room his dresser had been pushed up against the closet door. And she thought that was kind of weird, and Andrew wasn't bleeding a lot. He had bandaged up himself. It was around his neck area. So he bandaged it all up and he waited like 45 minutes.
According to this woman, Andrew borrowed her car to go to the hospital and she went along in the passenger seat.
They went to the hospital. So it was a flesh wound in the neck area. So they had to stitch it up and they did watch him for a while, but nothing serious. While at the hospital, I guess his girlfriend and somebody else went and cleaned out his room, I'm hearing from these people. And Andrew got out of the hospital and I guess cleaned his room real deeply.
I was able to obtain the file for the homicide investigation that the Everett Police Department conducted at the home. According to the report, while Andrew was at the hospital for the wound to his neck, the police were called out on his behalf, and he refused to speak to them about the incident. Although he wouldn't speak to the police, he was posting on Facebook. On the 14th, he posted a meme that has a picture of someone in prison talking on the phone, and it said, "When shit gets real, you see who's real." Later that day, he posted another meme that said, "Straight out of felonies, no seriously, I can't get another one, they'll throw my ass in prison forever." You may be wondering if Andrew posted memes like this often. But most of his posts from before this that I could see were photos of his daughter. 2 days later, Andrew wrote, "Sorry, I don't know what write a statement means. I know nothing. Ain't you new? Hashtag thought you had one." Maybe these social media posts aren't related to Antonio's disappearance, but what if they are? Could they have been vague messages to people who had been at the house that night? When Andrew came home from the hospital, in front of some of the other roommates, one of the guys asked Andrew a question, and his answer has always made them wonder.
When Andrew got out of the hospital, the David guy asked if they should go kick Antonio's ass, and Andrew said that, "Don't worry, it's already been taken care of."
Was Andrew just trying to sound tough, or is there something more to that statement? We know some of Andrew's friends cleaned his room while he was in the hospital, and Andrew did a more thorough cleanup when he got home. According to the police report, the roommates told the Everett police that after Andrew was arrested in late January for something unrelated to Antonio, they decided to kick him out of the house. Andrew had friends come by to pick up his belongings, and after that, the roommates went in to clean out the room. They noticed that the wall had been scrubbed so clean in certain areas that the paint had been worn off. They also noticed what they thought was blood on other things in the room.
I guess there was an area rug that was really filthy dirty, and that still filthy dirty after Andrew apparently cleaned it with a carpet cleaner, that they thought blood was on, big blood stain on the mattress, blood in the closet, blood on a vent, like a heater vent or something, on the windowsill, outside the house, on a lemonade stand, and in the trunk of the car. This is all where the roommates thought that there was blood.
At this point, the police were made aware of what was going on in the house, and when they came to do a search of the property, they found what looked like blood on several items in Andrew's room, and also in the trunk of one woman's car, the woman who had let him use her car to go to the hospital. One of the roommates took the officers over to the side of the house and pointed out that the cover to the crawl space had been moved. This crawl space access point was right under Andrew's window. They noticed some stains around the outside of the window that looked like they could be blood, too. Officers felt that the amount of suspected blood they were seeing was more than what they would have expected from the wound on Andrew's neck. Because of this, they decided to secure Andrew's room as a crime scene and come back with a search warrant. Officers locked the door and placed crime scene tape on the door and windows. Detectives returned the following day with a warrant and began to process this potential crime scene. A couple weeks later, on February 15th, they brought out a cadaver dog to search the entire property, but the dog found nothing. According to the people in the house, a few days after getting out of the hospital, Andrew had again asked to borrow the car and was gone with it overnight. When he returned it, the owner found a big stain in the trunk and what she thought looked like blood on her diaper bag. She asked Andrew why there was blood in the trunk, and he made a remark to her that it must have been from when he went to the hospital. But this didn't make sense because she knew that he had not been near the trunk, and he had already bandaged himself up before getting in the car, so he wasn't bleeding all over the place. She had washed the bag, but the stain in the trunk was still there for the police to see. The crime lab tested the trunk liner and found that the stain was not blood after all. They also tested the stains from inside the room. The mattress had three stains that were tested. Stain number one was a very large blood stain. The police report described it as being 3 feet in diameter. They found the stain had DNA from at least two people. Most of it came from a single female source, and that source was not related to Antonio. They weren't able to compare the other DNA found in stain one because the mixture offered such limited genetic information. Stain number two, again, was a mixture originating from at least two individuals. The major component originated from a single male source, but Antonio was again ruled out. Just like with the first stain, there wasn't enough genetic material present to determine if Antonio could have been one of the contributors. The third stain was determined to be a mixture originating from at least four people. Due to the complexity of this mixture, they weren't able to determine if Antonio's DNA was present. When they tested the other swabs that were collected from the home to determine if they contained blood, the tests were negative. What once appeared to be an open and shut case against Andrew was now falling apart.
They were very suspect that Andrew did something to Antonio when they initially got a hold to the police. But then once the investigation took off, there was no eyewitnesses of anything. And DNA blood did not end up matching Antonio's. And they ended up doing a polygraph on Andrew. He was in jail and he passed his polygraph. So then they closed the no body murder investigation.
With the murder investigation at the home now closed, there wasn't much more to go on. Did Antonio really stab Andrew that night and run out of the house? Or had the efforts to clean up the room been successful enough to cover up what actually happened? There are several theories and stories out there about what may have happened to Antonio, but so far, none of them have panned out, or had any evidence to suggest that there's any truth to them. As recent as last summer, someone claimed to have seen Antonio.
I've had some false leads. The summer of 2017, one of Antonio's old friends thought that they saw him in Seattle Pike Place Market area. And she hadn't seen him since high school, which was 2012, was when he graduated. And she thought it was him. she says that she didn't think about it until afterwards. Oh my gosh, I think that was Antonio. She was in a hurry walking with her daughter. So we ended up going back, getting surveillance of that area, and watching the tapes to see who she described. And we saw the guy that she thought was Antonio, and it wasn't him, unfortunately. At first, when I was watching the tape, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, maybe. But so it was, there was resemblance, but it wasn't him. So, and also another guy in a stranger thought he saw Antonio. He came forward and he thought he saw Antonio in the Westlake area in Seattle. And Antonio did not frequent Seattle, but that didn't give me hope that maybe it was him. And I involved the More Love organization in the Union Gospel Mission, and they did a search through the homeless camps down there. And Antonio had never been to a homeless camp and stayed. If he didn't have a solid place, he was always like staying at his dad's or at a friend's house. But I was like, well, you know, what's it going to hurt? We need to look for him. These people think they saw him, and nothing ever leaded up to Antonio again. Pretty much, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at now. Recently, we had a girl come forward. This has been like almost 2 years. And she says that she heard Antonio was murdered by a group in a basement. And then his body was brought to Granite Falls. My detective can't get a hold of this girl who states this. But that was just like probably a month ago she came forward to say that.
In the police file, I saw another sighting of Antonio. A man came forward and said he knew Antonio from AA meetings, but he didn't know him very well. The man stated that he was at a local grocery outlet on Christmas Eve to purchase turkeys for a meal that he prepares for the homeless each year. That's when he encountered a man that he believed was Antonio. He described him as drawn out, but not high. The person that he thought was Antonio said that he was staying at a place called the Recovery Cafe in Everett. Detectives attempted to get the surveillance footage from the grocery outlet, but they only retained videos for 1 week, which had long since passed. They also went to the Recovery Cafe, and no one there was familiar with Antonio. This appeared to be yet another dead end. Even though the no-body homicide case has been closed, Jenny is still left with lingering suspicions about what happened the evening that Antonio disappeared. The behavior of those who were in the house still seems strange. She's gotten messages from people who were there or who were told information from those who were there that night. The stories just don't seem to add up.
Something happened, and they're just all drugged out and scared. The initial guy also, the one who reported it in the first place, they moved out of state like right away. Him and his girlfriend got out of that house. They said there's bad juju and all that, and they left.
Another strange incident that has come to light was from the woman who had gone in the car with Andrew to the hospital.
These people are very unpredictable, unreliable. But she also says that he took her for a car ride after Antonio was missing, and he was like very scary. She said speeding down like this wooded area in a gravel road, pounding his fist against the steering wheel, complaining about going to jail. He doesn't want to go to jail. And she's like, she said she was scared. She wasn't sure if it had anything to do with Antonio or whatnot. But there's things like that. Multiple people have heard that he says he knows how to make people disappear. Who knows what any of that means? But I do think he has something to do with Antonio's disappearance, whether he did it or if he had friends that did it.
We know that when Antonio left with Andrew on the evening of the 12th, he didn't really have anything of monetary value with him because all of that had been stolen along with his car. But Jenny did pack him a backpack with some clothes and a duffel bag with a sleeping bag and pillow. Antonio didn't take any of those items with him when he supposedly ran out the door. And what Andrew did with those items has made Jenny suspicious.
This was the dead of winter, too. It was very cold at that time. When Antonio left my house, he had on a North Face, like a non-hooded shell. And then he had a North Face raincoat on top of that. He had, he had a beanie with him. He had Timberland boots on. He had a lot of stuff. And then supposedly, when he did that, he left in his t-shirt. in the dead of winter. Andrew was giving away his stuff, his bag. He left his bags there and his coats and everything there. He was giving it away.
When Antonio first disappeared, Jenny had been in contact with Andrew. Do you think it's strange that instead of giving Antonio's belongings back to Jenny, that Andrew was giving them away to other people? Did he know that Antonio wasn't coming back? While I was reviewing the file for the no-body homicide investigation, I could see mentions of another story. One that's a little bit different. Witnesses who were there that night spoke about something being moved out of the back of the house. Something big rolled up in a carpet. Mentions of a body being moved in a Jeep late that night. But that isn't the vehicle that was searched. There were also claims that those who were there that evening may have been threatened into silence. Some of them have said that they were woken up and ordered to clean up blood with disinfecting wipes. Are these stories just stories, or is there some truth behind them? Is the story that Antonio ran off after stabbing Andrew the truth? If he did, why has he been missing for so long? Jenny feels that he would have been picked up by now or contacted someone to let them know that he's okay, even if he was hiding from the police or from Andrew.
None of his friends, like I have friends that I wouldn't want Antonio around, and they were reaching out to me like drug friends. Where's Antonio? I haven't heard from him. This is really weird. And these are people that I would kill Antonio if I knew he was with, because I know they're drug users, you know, and these people haven't even seen him. These are the people that if he's down and out, he'd go to. And none of them have seen him. And he grew up in Everett. So he was born and raised in Everett. And he knows so many people. And nobody has seen him or heard from him.
Jenny has been doing everything she can to find her son since the last time she saw him in December of 2016. She's lived with a lot of regrets for letting him leave on the evening of the 12th, but there's no way that she could have predicted what was about to happen.
And Antonio, you know, was clean when he got out of jail, and then he went and stayed with a friend. And then he came back that morning, like 8:30 in the morning, and then we spent the whole day together. And, he was with me, so he wasn't using Ben either. And so he went over there clean. And it's like, I have so much guilt for even sending him away that day. But I thought nothing of it. I was like, okay, Andrew has a lot of charisma too. You know, he's a good talker. He's very charming. You know, I hugged Andrew and everything. Thank you for taking him in. And, you know, oh yeah, no worry, Jenny, I'll look after him. Because he's a little older than Antonio. He had his daughter in the back seat of his car too. She was like two or three. Or when he picked Antonio up. I mean, like, so I totally didn't think anything. Like, I thought they were just going to, we're just going to go land around the house. It did not look like a sticky situation. But we totally trusted the situation.
You may be wondering about Antonio's car. Could the theft of his vehicle have anything to do with his disappearance? Jenny told me that they did eventually find his car, and it appeared that someone had just driven it around for a period of time and trashed it. They don't believe that the car theft is connected to his disappearance. So what happened to Antonio on December 12, 2016? Did he really stab Andrew in the neck and run away? If so, where did he go? And why has no one seen him since? Or did something happen to him inside that house? If there was some kind of altercation, what was the motive behind it? No one has been able to find any history of issues between Antonio and Andrew. If Antonio did stab Andrew, did he just jump out from around the corner, as Andrew stated, or was there some other kind of fight? How did a house full of people miss that? Jenny told me that she's wondered if the stab wound was self-inflicted because it was so minor. Is this stabbing story all just a cover-up of something else? We know that Antonio had relapsed, then went to jail because that was a violation of his probation. When he got out on the 11th, he had been cleaned for the period of time that he was in jail. Could he have overdosed and the people in the house panicked? I know that Jenny is convinced that the people who were there that night must know more. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. When Jenny contacted me to ask if I would cover Antonio's case, I couldn't help but make a connection between two other cases that I recently covered from this area. Back in February, I covered the 2017 disappearance of 28-year-old Todd Renard. He went missing from nearby Bellingham, Washington. In March, I covered the disappearance of 24-year-old Jacob Hilken, who was last seen in Tulalip, Washington on January 23, 2018. Todd, Jacob, and Antonio all battled with heroin addiction. In each of these episodes, we heard from their moms about how their sons struggled, and also about how bad the problem is locally. There are places all over this country dealing with this epidemic. But I wanted to get a better idea of what's going on in this area of Washington, and what's being done to help. I spoke to Heather Thomas, who is a spokesperson for the Snohomish Health District. She explained that multiple agencies within Snohomish County are working together to tackle this issue by treating it like they would any other kind of disaster.
Well, I think one thing that we're still trying to wrap our hands around is really the scope of what the opioid problem is in Snohomish County. Until recently, the only litmus test we had for whether we were making inroads or how severe it was death certificates and death data that we wouldn't get until 12 or 18 months down the road. So, you know, it was 2016, but we were still looking at 2014 numbers. In the last year, Snohomish County has brought together partners from different agencies, and we've created what's called the Opioid Response MAC Group, and that's Multi-Agency Coordination. That includes the Snohomish Health District as the local health public health jurisdiction. And then the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, the Snohomish County Government, and then the County Council were the ones that officially formed the group last November. And we've followed an emergency management framework. So just like we would respond to flooding or landslides or other major emergencies, we structure ourselves so that we have our own kind of lead areas that agencies are responsible for. And we have joint goals and joint objectives that we are meeting every 2 weeks to talk about how things are progressing, if we're hitting any speed bumps, or what resources are needed to achieve objectives that we've identified. And through this effort, we've been able to also get at further data pieces. So for instance, I can say back in 2011, that was where we had the highest number of opioid-related deaths in Snohomish County, and that was 145 in 2011. 2011 also represents when we had the highest number of deaths related to prescription opioids. And that was when the pharmaceutical industry started to reformulate OxyContin, the most predominantly abused opioid, so that it became an extended release medication, and it was harder to abuse. So since 2011, we've seen a pretty steady decrease in the number of prescription opioid deaths. But along with that, we're seeing an increasing number in heroin deaths and synthetic opioids. So synthetic opioids would be like fentanyl or carfentanil, which are much more lethal than prescription opioids. The other piece, when we look at just the opioid-related deaths, is in 2015, our county started a big push on distributing Narcan or naloxone, the life-saving antidote for overdoses. And that's been one of the primary reasons why we're seeing actually a decrease in the total number of deaths in Snohomish County. So while it's good to see less deaths, that doesn't mean necessarily the prescription opioid or heroin problem is being solved in Snohomish County. So the other piece that we're working on is getting data at different places so that we can get an estimated number of residents that are struggling with opioid abuse in Snohomish County.
The Snohomish County Sheriff is very passionate about this issue as well. This is Sheriff Ty Trenary speaking at a community forum about some of the things the Sheriff's Department is trying to do to tackle the unique problems associated with the opioid epidemic.
It's nice to see support from the community. I know that if you've been watching this process, it probably feels like it's taken a little while. And I'll just be very candid with you and tell you that this is not a simple solution. If there had been a magic pill or some kind of magic formula, I assure you Chief Templeman and I would have enacted that quite some time ago. We've been really, really, really fortunate in our county to kind of have the sense of community that we do. So let me share what that means for just a second. We find that law enforcement is kind of a territorial lot. We talk a lot about jurisdiction, and we wear different uniforms, and we drive different cars because we really kind of believe in our little personal place on the planet that we protect. But very candidly, in Snohomish County, for many years, our law enforcement agencies have worked very, very well together. We don't really worry about borders or jurisdictions as much as we worry about the problem. So this has been kind of been a rocky road for us in understanding how bad the heroin epidemic is, understanding its impacts to homelessness and specifically mental illness, and then trying to figure out a way to fix it. I can't quote him exactly because I didn't print it off, but I found the comments by the Dallas police chief last week very, very interesting in that he talked about how we use law enforcement for everything. And sadly, it's really the only tool in our toolbox for society. And I think one of the things we've learned, certainly I've learned since I became sheriff, is we've got to kind of retool the way we do business. So, for example, using our jail as the de facto mental health hospital is not an appropriate way to treat people, and it's certainly not an appropriate use of that facility. Taking low-level offenders who have an addiction and trying to treat them through the criminal justice system, through arrest and incarceration, not only doesn't treat the problem, but quite frankly, it's the most expensive process to us as taxpayers with almost no results. And so what I found was there's hope. There's hope in the notion that the kinds of things that we're doing in partnership with the Everett Police Department by embedding social workers, about the idea that a police officer and a social worker ride in the same car together, and they go out and deal with our critically dependent population. I make this joke all the time, and it's gotten old, but if you told me 20 years ago my partner in a patrol car was going to be a social worker, I would have laughed at you, quite frankly. But the idea is now we go out into a homeless camp or we go out to problem locations and we spend the time to figure out what's really going on. So if someone has an addiction issue or a mental health issue, instead of writing a report or using a pair of handcuffs, the social worker and the police officer, deputy sheriff, spend time trying to find, okay, what kind of program can we get them into? And the idea isn't, hey, we'll give you a date and we'll see you in 3 months. Because that doesn't work. The idea is, what do you need to take with you? Let's pack it up. Let's take you and get you to a program.
When I was speaking to Heather Thomas, she echoed this sentiment. Incarceration doesn't cure addiction.
You know, we have a sheriff that's been very clear, you can't arrest your way out of this problem. There's a reason why somebody is using heroin or an opioid, and that's, it can be any number of reasons, but typically there's a hole that they're trying to fill or self-medicate or a pain, you know, a surgery or a medical condition where they were first introduced to opioids and they happen to be in the percent of the population where opioids trigger their receptors and they feel a sense of euphoria and they want to continue that feeling. So until there's a full wraparound treatment option of social supports and medication-assisted treatment or whatever method works for that specific individual, the reason why they are in jail won't go away. You know, what we do see is, you know, whichever path they take to try to get on the road to recovery, whether it's abstinence-based or detox or inpatient treatment or Medicaid, you know, whichever works for them, trying to get the counseling and the mental health support is really critical, as well as the housing and stability, because otherwise the people go back to the same environment they were in when they were using, or when a trigger happens, it could be the holidays, it could be the loss of a loved one, or, you know, any number of things. That's usually where we see the relapses happening, because in the past, they used opioids to cope. And so when they don't have that, they don't have any other skills to replace any other coping mechanisms to help them get through bumps in the road. And so that's why it's important that, you know, they talk about alcoholism and other things. It's a lifelong recovery. Very much the same with opioids. There's maintenance needed and constant support. It's not a one size fits all for each person.
I've mentioned on the show previously that this topic is important to me because of my own sister's very long battle with heroin addiction. I often get messages from many of you who listen thanking me for covering stories like Antonio's, because many of you can relate to these struggles, whether you've been through it yourself or someone else that you love. On the other hand, I sometimes get messages from those who feel that someone with an addiction isn't worthy of coverage. That's why I wanted to offer you a little more information about opioid addiction in general. I feel as though with more understanding, maybe we could see more empathy from the public. This is an issue that we all need to be informed about. I know in my own community, we have public forums just like the one you heard the sheriff speaking at, because we have an epidemic here too. Seeing all of these disappearances related to heroin is like a symptom of the larger opioid epidemic as a whole. If we're all aware and working together, maybe we can make some progress.
Addiction doesn't discriminate, especially opioid addiction, whether it's upper class or middle class, homeless or wealthy, or we see all walks of life. We see people that were injured on the job, or they had oral surgery, or someone gave them a pill and they took it and never looked back. You talk to anybody in the community, they know somebody that's either struggling or who has lost somebody, or they see the other community impacts, whether it's crime or needles found in the parks. I think sympathy and empathy are definitely needed, as well as trying to learn more about the illness and the disease of addiction. It's this double-edged sword of people that are in addiction. They tend to burn bridges and strain relationships, but once they're in recovery is really when they need that support the most.
If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Antonio Neal, please contact the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office at 425-388-3393. They also have an anonymous tip line, which is 425-388-3845. You can follow Antonio's case on Facebook, where Jenny runs Missing Antonio Neal. I'd like to thank Jenny and Heather for taking the time to speak with me for this episode. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter @thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Your 5-star reviews help others find the show. Another way to support The Vanished is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/vanished. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from West Virginia. Thanks for listening.
Somebody out there knows something. They need to come forward and help, you know, even if it's a rumor, just give more information to what they think they've heard, because that's the only honest to God thing we have, and it's not being investigated on. So it's pretty much case closed until something new comes out of it, and nothing new's coming, you know, just these random statements. And I mean, if we had somewhere to go to search, you know, that someone actually wants to talk to the police and say they think this or this area, I mean, it would be very helpful, so we can at least try to find Antonio to, you know, I don't honestly believe he's with us anymore. And I hate saying that, but my son would have contacted me by now.
Validated what I've always assumed happened. I know he didn't just run away. So it just validated it. I tried to get closure. I know that's what Antonio would want, but I can't.
When we originally aired Antonio's episode in 2018, he was still missing. His case had gone from a missing case to an active homicide investigation and back to a missing case once again. Antonio's mom was left in limbo, not knowing what happened to her son. All she had to go on were these strange stories coming from people who had been in the house with Antonio on the night that he disappeared. Was it true that Antonio had stabbed Andrew in the neck, completely unprovoked, then ran out of the house, disappearing forever? Jenny never believed that this version of events was true, but there was no evidence to prove what exactly had happened. Then, just about 6 months after our original episode aired, and more than 2 years after Antonio had vanished, people walking along the shore of Jetty Island made a gruesome discovery. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 340 of The Vanished, an update on Antonio Neal's story. Jetty Island is a small island in the Possession Sound, which is part of the Puget Sound, an inlet of the Pacific Ocean and part of the Salish Sea. Jetty Island sits in the waterway just west of Everett and is about 2 miles long. The island is undeveloped, but offers sandy beaches that can be reached with just a short ferry ride from Everett. The only way to access Jetty Island is by boat. On January 1st, 2019, people walking along the beach on Jetty Island found a boot. Inside the boot was a human foot. We spoke to Antonio's mom, Jenny, again in March of 2022 to bring you an update on his story. Jenny explained that once the boot was found and she saw a photo of it, she was certain that it was Antonio's foot that had been recovered.
Jetty Island's a sandbar in Everett, and the only way to get out to Jetty Island is by boat. It's not far offshore, and it's the edge of Jetty Island is right at the mouth of the river, Snohomish River. The house he went disappearing from is literally maybe a 10-minute walk from that river. Every remains that have been found since we lost Antonio, I'm really quick to see it like on social media or whatever. And I message my detective and he's very prompt. He goes to every scene right away. And this scene, I didn't know about it, but he had heard about it and went there and literally sent me a picture because it was in a boot. And I identified his boot, his Timberland boot, and his socks, because I know he had put on double socks that day, because I watched him do it before he left my house. And I was able to identify the boot and socks. The boot was a black pair of Timberland boots, but it had turned brown from the salt water. And my detective was like, are you sure? You know, it's brown. You said they were black. I'm like, I know the exact style of the boot because it was like a street style of Timberlands and it folds down like a mesh. And I knew those were his boots. Anyways, so that's how I knew right away before DNA matched him. Our theory is that he was disposed of in the river and then through natural decomp, his boot floated. And then as it was going out to sea, it got stuck on because it was found right on the very tip of Jetty Island, which is at the mouth of the river.
Jenny was hopeful that finding Antonio's foot would lead to the discovery of more of his remains. But at the time, it was too dangerous to search the rough waters.
It was really cold. It was January. And in Washington, it makes the water really dangerous to search in. So it was postponed for a while until they could get it calm enough to go out there. And that was kind of frustrating, too, because, you know, the choppiness of the waters obviously are going to cover up anything that's being unearthed. They've done sonar searches of the water and they do their search and rescue training in that water. So he says every time they train in the water, obviously they're searching for Antonio amongst whatever else they can find. Nobody seems too promising just because it is a river that goes out into the Puget Sound. So tides, all the tide changing and water levels and things and all the debris under there, he can be trapped is what the theory is he's trapped. And literally the house he went missing from is like right by the river. And then it's not even, I don't even think it's a full mile to where the river spits out to Jetty Island from where he went missing.
Further searches of the area continued to turn up empty. Jenny made trips out to the area where Antonio's foot had washed ashore, just hoping she might stumble upon more clues.
I have been out there along the rivers looking for clothing, you know, anything like that. I can't remember the brand of jeans he was wearing, but at one time I did find a pair of jeans and it freaked me out. And it was around the size he wore, you know, so it's just like, is this his? But then that could be a homeless guy's jeans, you know, like for all I know. Anyways, they weren't willing to go out there and get the jeans either. So that was a little frustrating.
When Antonio's foot was recovered, they could tell that it hadn't been cut off. It had naturally separated from his body during the decomposition process. So finding just Antonio's foot has made it impossible to determine his cause of death. Often you'll hear of a foot being found in a shoe, because as a body decomposes underwater, the first things to break off are the hands and feet, due to the small joints. If there are shoes on the feet when this happens, they're more protected from scavenger animal activity, therefore more likely to be found. The material that is used to make many styles of shoes in recent years causes shoes to be more buoyant and more likely to float ashore. Finding Antonio's foot thrust Jenny out of one kind of limbo, wondering if her son could still be out there alive, to now knowing that he was gone, but not sure what happened to him or how to prove that someone harmed Antonio.
That's the crappy part about it is, yes, personally, my detective suspects foul play. What he can prove is nothing. With just his foot, we do not have a source of how he died. So, and given that the foot was through natural decomp and not severed, he can't say it was a murder per se because we don't have any other evidence. No witnesses, no body, if we could find another piece of his body that can tell, you know, anything that could tell the way of death. That's what's so frustrating, is they cannot say it was a homicide just with what we have in speculation.
Over the years, there have been a number of feet that have washed ashore in the Salish Sea, along the coastal regions of Washington State and British Columbia. Some have hinted at this being part of a larger conspiracy, or perhaps the work of a serial killer. But scientists believe that the truth behind this is far less interesting, and has more to do with how bodies decompose in water, and how shoes have been made with more buoyant material in recent decades. Jenny doesn't believe that there is any greater conspiracy here either. She doesn't see any connection between Antonio and the other feet that have surfaced.
It's been going on up and down Canada, and then on down to Washington. Then there's theories that there's a serial killer. I don't like him getting clumped into that group, because his is totally unrelated.
In the years that have passed since Antonio's foot was found, Jenny has continued to hear rumors about what happened to her son, but still nothing concrete.
There was a group of people that were there that has still have been unaccounted for. A girl was in jail with another girl and said that she witnessed a kid get murdered, Antonio. She was telling this to another cellmate. And the cellmate, she happened to have known Antonio, and it got through to me. But then it was lost on who this girl was. So we never got to talk to her. And then, I don't know if it was a year later or what, but a coworker's daughter was in a treatment facility in Seattle area. And her roommate said a similar story to what I heard from this other girl's story, that she witnessed it. She knows what happened. Her boyfriend at the time was there, and that it was a group of people that killed him. And she said they acted as if they were a cult, like they have each other's backs, like it was a real scary situation. She used the word cult, which was weird. And I was like, cult, like a gang. So this girl tells her mom, then her mom told me, and we fished out, we got warrant to see who that girl is, the detective did, and went to talk to her. And she proceeded to say, I didn't say that. And he's like, well, who's your boyfriend at the time? I don't know. I don't remember his name. So unrelated people, the daughter of my friend never met Antonio, totally unrelated, said that this girl just started talking about a death that she had witnessed and ended up name dropping Antonio. I guess her daughter just acted as if she had never heard of it and got all this out of her. I've never heard of the girl either. So I'm assuming she was there, but is chickening out. Like she was one of the people that are unaccounted for. It was at the beginning of COVID too, which it was really hard. He was unwilling to go meet with people in person, people talking about it to other people, and jail when they're like sobering up. They start talking, and then it's like, I feel like they get out and they relapse, and then they hide it all again, or they're threatened. They're afraid, because the girl who was talking in treatment was obviously afraid of these people describing them as a cult, you know, describing them as scary people.
It has been more than 5 years since Antonio first disappeared, and really not much has changed. Jenny still has her suspicions about the people he was with the night that he went missing. Their actions since we first aired Antonio's story have only made her more suspicious.
He just jumped out of behind the door, assaulted him, and ran off. Yeah, this is only Andrew who says this, the only witness to that. So we have no witnesses that are willing to come forward with any evidence besides the person who last saw Antonio alive, Andrew, and his account for it. He refuses to talk to police. He was actually arrested not that long ago. This year, like a few months ago. And as he's fleeing on foot from the police, and they finally capture him with a canine, he says, you all think I killed that kid. You all think I killed that kid. And they're like, who are you talking about? You know, he's like, you know that Antonio kid. I went and I told my detective this. My detective then found out who and what the whole story was. But so this is still on his conscience that he thinks the cops are after him because they think he killed that kid. They stick to their story. I've been told that one of the people that lived there, his vehicle was the one used to transport Antonio out of the house. That vehicle has been destroyed, so we can't get anything from it anymore because Everett never searched it. So when they go to interview him, he just declines all of that, of course. And his girlfriend, Bree, the one who had also been there, but they were sleeping at the time, he won't allow her to talk to the police. So I had posted the story about what happened that night, and Andrew actually commented on it, trying to say I'm slandering him and this and that, but it's not slander if you were actually the last person to see Antonio alive. And just saying things that are awful as if to me, like, oh, you know, your son was living under a bridge, which wasn't true. You know, just like a bunch of BS bullshit. Like I'm a bad mom, and he's just trying to get it in my gut because I put him out there again. The only reason he knew I posted it was because of his current girlfriend, who knows nothing about it, saw it. And then she was questioning it. He didn't like that very much. I deleted him.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
You've heard updates from other families who are in the same position that Jenny is in today. They have found a very small portion of their missing loved one. That closes the door on the idea that the person is alive and just wanted to start over somewhere new. We often hear families being told that adults can disappear if they want to. But these kinds of conclusions leave too many questions unanswered.
It validated what I've always assumed happened. I know he didn't just run away. So it just validated it. I tried to get closure. I know that's what Antonio would want, but I can't. I have his foot buried at a cemetery, you know, but I still go to the river every year and send him a cupcake for his birthday down the river because I know that's where my son is. That's where I feel he is. So it's not any comfort really getting that or closure. Because the guy who did it is still out there. And I know karma, you know, will come around, and I get that. But it's tough for me just to hang out and wait, you know, for things to happen. And I don't know what to do about it is my problem. Every time I think I have a witness that's willing to talk, they back out of it. He says it's so difficult with no body, no cause of death, no witnesses, and no evidence. No DNA evidence to push forward for a murder. And the last thing we want is it to lose or something in court that he can't do it again. And I'm not convinced he did it alone either. So it would have been the middle of the night, according to the time frame. And that part of Everett's suspicious anyways activity, it's not a really good place. But honestly, nothing substantial. Nothing groundbreaking that we can actually move forward. the detective just always assures me, yes, the case is still an open case. It's just cold, and he won't close it until it's solved. It's not discouraging, and I'm so happy for families that have went through this around the same time as me, but some of the other missing guys that had went missing around the same time of Antonio, they have been found. It always gives me hope.
We wanted to bring attention to Antonio's case again by doing an update, because investigators are still looking for someone to come forward with information.
He didn't go missing on his own. We think he was murdered. We think this is foul play all the way, and that they think they're going to get away with it. Somebody needs to come forward, find it in their heart. They can be totally anonymous.
So what happened to Antonio Neal on that fateful December night in 2016? Did Antonio freak out, stab Andrew, run out of the house, and somehow ended up in the waterways surrounding Everett? Or did something more sinister occur that night, and everything else was a cover story? Antonio's family believes that some sort of foul play occurred the night that he went missing, and that Antonio's body was dumped in the Snohomish River, which was not far from the house Antonio was last seen at. The river flows from there out into the Puget Sound, right near the area where Antonio's foot was found. Jenny believes that the rest of Antonio's body is likely stuck somewhere along that waterway, and that they only found his foot because it broke off during the decomposition process and floated away. But with so little to go on, Jenny is just patiently waiting for someone to do the right thing and come forward with information about what happened the night that Antonio disappeared. If you have any information regarding the disappearance and death of Antonio Neal, please contact the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office at 425-388-3393. Crime Stoppers is currently offering a $1,000 reward for information on Antonio's case. To submit a tip anonymously through Crime Stoppers, go to p3tips.com or call 1-800-222-TIPS.
I had a dream. I never dream about Antonio. And first, this isn't my dream. I was driving to work and a song came on the radio. It was like the 21 Pilots song. Stressed Out, I think that's what it's called. And Antonio really liked that song before he went missing. And I was like, oh, so I listened to it. And then after that, a song came on by the Smashing Pumpkins, the Today is the Best Day of My Life or whatever. And so I listened to that because I know Antonio liked that song. Then I changed the station and the 21 Pilots song was on again. So I was like, okay, that's kind of weird. So I listened to it. And then I changed the station to the next station again. And it was that Smashing Pumpkins song. So I was like, okay, this is really weird. That evening, I went to sleep and I finally dream about Antonio for the first time. And he was beautiful. He was glowing. He looked so happy. It was me and my aunt in this dream. And we were just crying and questioning him. Where are you? What happened? What's going on? And he just kept smiling at us and we're crying. It was in the driveway of a house. And crying and hugging him, and he said nothing. He just held up a big lowercase letter B. That I just was going to share that because I have not dreamed of him since. Yeah, my aunt's convinced the B was for boot, you know, because we ended up finding his boot.
That brings us to the end of episode 340. I'd like to thank Jenny for coming back to give us an update. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be covering a case from California. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.